Hello, and welcome back to ACRAC. I'm Jed Wolpaw, and I am back with the one and only Dr. Tim Kaistura for another ABA keyword episode. This time, we're going to tackle a kind of a grab bag, I guess, that they're calling common complications in anesthesia, which really, I guess some are common, some are not, but as we just said, talking offline, this is kind of highly tested complications from anesthesia. So you need to know it. Some of them you may see, some of them you may never see, but we're going to go over it for you. And Tim, welcome back to the show.
Thanks so much for having me as always. And just like last time, we're going to kick off today with a little bit of spaced repetition and review some questions from previous keyword episodes. In no particular order, Jed, question number one. A 59-year-old female with obesity, obstructive sleep apnea, high blood pressure, and diabetes presents to an ambulatory surgery center for a distal toe amputation. The patient refuses regional anesthesia, and you proceed with general anesthesia. Which of a patient's risk factors is most likely to result in unplanned postoperative hospital admission? A, obstructive sleep apnea, B, high blood pressure, or C, obesity?
Yeah, you know, I think this is a little tricky. Obviously, if you remember when we talked about it last time, it wouldn't be, but because these things all seem, they all are risk factors. I think maybe one way to think about this, just from a test-taking perspective, is which is the least common, right? Obesity and high blood pressure are so common that it seems unlikely they give you something that so many people have, whereas obstructive sleep apnea, though getting more common, is not as common, and certainly also is something that, you know, we see a lot of patients who can't pass a room air trial. They can't get out of the PACU because they can't saturate okay on room air because of their obstructive sleep apnea. So that's certainly what we see clinically. And I think from a test-taking perspective is the most likely as well. So I'd go with A, obstructive sleep apnea.
Right. I think that's a great approach. And certainly there are BMI cutoffs at ambulatory surgery centers, but it's not just the presence of obesity. High blood pressure is not a contraindication. But if you work in a hospital setting, certainly you've taken care of a patient that at first you look at and say, why is this being done in a hospital setting? And it's often the bad obstructive sleep apnea or something like that that has brought them to you. Question number two. You are performing an awake fiber optic nasal intubation and have injected local anesthetic via the transtracheal approach. This action most likely affects the A, glossopharyngeal nerves, B, recurrent laryngeal nerves, or C, the internal branch of the superior laryngeal nerves.
Yeah, so, you know, this is one of those things, I think tracheal nerve anatomy that you do just have to kind of remember. I'm sure people may have some mnemonics and things to remember it, but the way I think about this is that the transtracheal block is getting all of the cords, the subcord area, and the cords themselves. That's kind of the, what I think of as the most important area. If you've ever done an awake intubation, when you get to the cords, if they're not adequately anesthetized, that's what causes people to cough and gag like crazy. Not gag, but choke, cough and choke like crazy. And so the recurrent laryngeal nerves are what innervate that. It's the kind of the most important nerve for an awake intubation. And so I think about the transtracheal block as being very effective for this, and that is what it is. The recurrent laryngeal nerve is what you get from your transtracheal block.
Absolutely. And just and thinking anatomically, those are the nerves that are sort of running, have looped down, recurred, and are now coming back up. So they're coming up through that space as they go to their way to the vocal cords. Question number three. Soon after emergence and extubation from general anesthesia for a lower extremity orthopedic procedure, a patient becomes hypoxic. Their breathing becomes rapid, which is most likely mediated by activity of which area? A, carotid bodies, B, carotid sinuses, or C, aortic bodies?
Yeah, this is, I think we talked about some mnemonics for this last time. So what I think of is, I think CBC, carotid bodies, chemoreceptors, carotid sinus, like sinus pressure. So the carotid sinuses are pressure, like you get sinus pressure when you have a sinus cold. And then the aortic bodies are less important, but also ABC are also chemoreceptors, but they're less important. They play less of a role. Interestingly, that's specific to humans. They play more of a role in some animals, but in humans play less of a role. And so here, what we're talking about is hypoxia, which is a chemical, it's a PaO2 chemical response. It's not about the blood pressure. It's about the partial pressure of oxygen, and so it's going to be the chemoreceptor of the carotid body, CBC, carotid body chemoreceptor is going to be your right answer here. If it had been about hypotension, it would be the carotid sinuses, and if I don't even know how they'd ask about the aortic bodies other than if they maybe didn't give you carotid bodies as an example, and it was a chemoreceptor response.
Right, and even then, though, so you're right that the aortic bodies are a little you can call it a little less important, but specifically, they just don't drive the hyperventilatory response. They shift some of these same other things that the carotid bodies do. To remember that distinction, and remember that the carotid bodies are closer to the brainstem where the ventilatory systems are. So that's the one that drives that hyperventilatory response.
Great.
Question number four, you induce anesthesia for a patient undergoing ECT treatment for major depression. What is the most common autonomic nervous system response following seizure onset? A, initial bradycardia followed by tachycardia and hypertension. B, initial tachycardia followed by bradycardia and hypotension. C, initial bradycardia with a return to baseline.
Yeah, so if you, I mean, obviously if you've done these, you've seen it. If not, then, you know, you kind of have to memorize this. It is going to be A, initial bradycardia followed by tachycardia and hypertension. I don't personally have a great mnemonic or anything to remember that. Tim, do you?
I don't, but what it's testing here is just, do you remember that it's a parasympathetic response followed by a sympathetic response? That's sort of what you need to know.
Yeah.
All right, great. So with that warm-up under our belt, we'll move on to today's main topic, which is pulled from the basic outline. So this sits in basic topics in anesthesiology under clinical science, anesthesia procedures, methods, and techniques. It's number six in that list, common complications. And as you said, it's a strange list. They're not all particularly common. Some of them are perioperative. Some of them are directly related to anesthesia. The subcategories here are A, trauma, and they have upper airway and larynx and eyes and vascular and neurological and burns in there. B is chronic environmental exposure and scavenging. C is temperature, both hypothermia and non-malignant hyperthermia. D is bronchospasm. E is latex allergy. F is laryngospasm. G is post-obstructive pulmonary edema. H is aspiration of gastric contents. And I is malignant hyperthermia. And we need to get some of the same caveats out of way as always. These episodes are aimed at preparation for board examination. So we'll be focusing on the highly tested topics. I scour a lot of different test prep materials, including previously released exams, to see what comes up most frequently. And whenever possible, see what textbooks cover, since question writers have to ultimately cite sources like that coming up with these test items. So what we'll see below is just what I think is tested the most, and this may change over time, but the ABA does want you to know everything in that list. So if there's something we didn't cover that you're unfamiliar with, you will have to brush up on it. The first section we'll cover is trauma. The ABA groups a broad set of mechanical injuries under trauma, from dental damage during intubation to peripheral nerve injuries from positioning. What gets tested consistently comes to a few high-yield patterns. What goes wrong with the airway during and after intubation, what causes perioperative visual loss, and which nerves are most vulnerable under an anesthesia. Key concept one, the most common complication of direct laryngoscopy is dental trauma. If a tooth is dislodged and can't be found, you need to get chest and abdominal x-rays to rule out aspiration and figure out where it went. And then once the tube is in, the most common in situ complication is endobronchial intubation. And as a reminder, it's neck flexion, not extension, that pushes the tube deeper by shifting the carina cephalad. And I'll be honest that that's just something that I still need to force myself to understand as fact. It still anatomically does not make complete sense to me. And then delayed extubation complications include laryngeal ulceration, tracheal stenosis, vocal cord paralysis, and arytenoid dislocation. Key concept two, corneal abrasions are the most common perioperative eye injury and can be prevented by taping or protecting the eyes, which is why we always stress that. And then perioperative visual loss is relatively rare but can be catastrophic. It's most commonly caused by ischemic optic neuropathy, followed by retinal artery occlusion. Risk factors for ION or ischemic optic neuropathy include prone positioning with large blood loss, that's sort of the most commonly tested one, as well as male sex, obesity, use of Wilson frame, and the amount of perioperative IV fluids. The more edema you cause, the higher the risk of possible ION. And there's no proven treatment once it occurs. If you have any concern for any type of vision loss, don't blame it on residual anesthesia, anything like that. Just get the ophthalmology consult right away. Key concept three, the ulnar nerve is the most commonly injured peripheral nerve under general anesthesia. It's vulnerable at the medial epicondyle, where it can be compressed against the table edge. The median nerve, when injured, which is most commonly from IV fluid extravasation at the antecubital fossa, causes sensory and motor deficits in the first three digits. The common perineal nerve is at risk at the fibular head and lithotomy position, and a significant portion of nerve injuries occur despite appropriate positioning, which suggests that ischemia plays a role independent of padding. This is also, I think, commonly tested because these injuries show up very commonly in our closed claim databases.
Yeah, two quick things, Tim. One, you know, the way I think about it is when you thinking about what you said about you don't have a great way to remember whether flexion or extension of the neck can cause the tube to get right main stem. The way I think of it is if you extend your neck, you make your neck longer. And so the tube is going to be less deep because now it's a longer neck. And when you mm-hmm. flex the neck, I think that of the neck becoming shorter and therefore the tube is now deeper because there's less neck, right? So that may or may not make sense, but that's how I think about it.
Yeah, that's certainly a quick way. And you said two things. What's the other one?
Yeah, the other thing is that I don't think we're covering it because obviously we can't cover everything, but the one thing that I think does come up that we didn't mention here, but that you did list in your list of things is burns. And I will say the most common way that I think burns get tested, and I've seen it on my keeping up with licensure questioning, is the simple fact of they give you a scenario with a airway fire, and what do you do first? And you got to get that tube out, right? Just pull the tube out. That may seem counterintuitive because you think, now I don't have an airway, but you have to realize the airway has become a blowtorch and you have to get it out. It's no longer a functioning airway and won't be. So that's the key thing to know, I think, about airway fires.
Yeah. This is an interesting list because this is common complications. It doesn't hit a lot of the operating room emergencies. So there's no oxygen failure, power failure, airway fire, anything like that. Here, but that's a good point. And when those are tested, they should never, and I hope they never do, ask you to choose between turning off the oxygen and getting the tube out. Those things have to happen in tandem. You need the oxygen off because otherwise, as you're pulling it, it's just like a flammable torch that you're burning the airway as you come out. So in my head, always you want the oxygen off and tube out, but do it as quickly as possible.
Yeah.
Okay. Awesome. Question one. A 47-year-old morbidly obese male undergoes a 6-hour, 3-segment lumbar laminectomy in the prone position. MAP is maintained at 50 to 60 millimeters of mercury, and he receives 6 units of packed red blood cells. Postoperatively, he has bilateral vision loss. Which structure is most likely responsible? A. The central retinal artery, B. The optic nerve, or C. The cerebral cortex?
Yeah, so they're giving you a lot of risk factors for ischemic optic neuropathy here. It's a prone case. He's male. He's obese. He's hypotensive, and he got a lot of fluid. So kind of everything. And so it's probably ischemic optic neuropathy, so the optic nerve is going to be your right answer.
Perfect. Question number two. A 32-year-old man undergoes an 8-hour exploratory laparotomy. Postoperatively, he cannot oppose his left thumb to his little finger. Which nerve was most likely injured? A, the radial nerve, B, the ulnar nerve, or C, the median nerve?
Yeah, so the key here is try to do it, right? So when you try to oppose those, you're not moving your pinky very much. It's your thumb that is moving, right? Try to leave your thumb where it is and get your pinky over to it. You can't do it. So if you were thinking, if it's the pinky, it's one thing. If it's the thumb, it's another. You'd be right, but it's the thumb. The thumb is what allows you to get these two fingers opposed. And so, as you said, the thumb and the next two fingers are covered by the median nerve. So that's going to be a median nerve injury because it's your thumb that's problematic.
Yeah, and it's a little bit of a tricky question because it doesn't tell you anything else about mechanism, right? So if you thought about just the most common thing, you'd go with the ulnar nerve. But in terms of what they're telling you doesn't function, it's got to be the median nerve. Question three, which of the following is the most common peripheral nerve injury associated with general anesthesia? A, the ulnar nerve, B, the median nerve, or C, the common perineal nerve?
So this is where you have to know that it's the ulnar nerve. A little tricky because the common perineal nerve is a commonly tested nerve that gets injured because of the lithotomy position. But the overall, as you said in your intro, it's the ulnar nerve that's the most common.
Perfect. The ABA also lists several vascular complications under trauma, including arterial and venous thrombosis, air embolism, and pulmonary artery rupture. Again, not common things. But of these, venous air embolism is by far the most tested topic. So key concept four concerns that. Venous air embolism, or VAE, occurs when air enters the venous system, potentially causing right heart outflow obstruction via an airlock mechanism. It is most common during neurosurgical procedures in the sitting position, but it can occur anytime there is an open vein above the level of the heart. The most sensitive bedside monitor, other than TE, if you have one, is the precordial Doppler, which detects air before hemodynamic changes occur. And if you don't have either of those, end-tidal CO2 decreases as dead space increases from venous air embolism. And this may be the most recognizable monitoring change in most operating room cases. Treatment is with left lateral decubitus or Trendelenburg position if possible, attempting to aspirate the air via a central line. These are special central lines with multiple lumens that can pull out air. Stopping nitrous oxide if you're using it, which can expand air bubbles, and hemodynamic support. Anything to add or any questions about that?
No, I think, you know, I feel like we use less nitrous than we used to, but that is a huge one because if you look at the graphs of how quickly an air embolus, same with the pneumothorax, expand when you're using nitrous oxide, it is unbelievable how much faster it is than if you're not using nitrous oxide. So you got to get that off if you think you have an air embolus and you're using nitrous.
Perfect. Four, during a sitting craniotomy, the precordial Doppler detects a sudden high-pitched sound and the patient becomes hypotensive. What would be expected on end-tidal gas monitoring? A, increase in end-tidal nitrogen. B, increase in end-tidal carbon dioxide. Or C, decrease in end-tidal carbon dioxide.
Yeah, so what you see is a decrease in end-tidal CO2, and that is because you have a blockage, right? So you can't get the blood that has the CO2 in it to the lung for it to get into the alveoli for you to have end-tidal CO2. So the tricky thing here is that your pCO2 will go up in your blood, but your end-tidal CO2 will go down.
Yep. Partially just due to the same drop in end-tidal we see whenever we see a drop in cardiac output as well, though there is dead space in the lungs that's also contributing to it. What do you think about the increase in end-tidal nitrogen as a distractor?
Yeah, I mean, that's interesting. Well, first of all, we don't measure it. So, you know, I'm not sure how we would even know that. I think, yeah, I guess I don't have a better option than that. We don't measure it, so I'd have to even think through what happens to end-tidal nitrogen.
Yeah,
I mean,
I think it's not, it depends what's being inhaled. Because if you're on air, then there wouldn't be any change. If you're on pure oxygen and you start getting in nitrogen, you could theoretically have an increase in it, but it wouldn't be the most reliable or sensitive. So I'm not sure that it's the best wrong answer, but it comes up sometimes, and it's definitely not what you should be looking for a venous air embolus.
Right. I mean, there is no nitrogen in the blood, right? So when there is end-tidal nitrogen, it is just because nitrogen went in and came right back out without getting absorbed
right
into the blood. So, I don't think that in the case of an air embolus, I don't think there's any change that because it was whatever you put in is what you're going to get back out.
Yeah. Perfect. Next, we'll talk about temperature. We'll hit malignant hyperthermia last, where it sits in the outline. So for now, we'll just cover hypothermia. The non-malignant hyperthermias aren't that high yield, except as they're tested against malignant hyperthermia, which again, we'll hit at the end. Hypothermia is nearly universal in the OR without active prevention, and its complications extend well into the postoperative period. Key concept five, perioperative heat loss occurs by radiation, convection, conduction, and evaporation, with radiation and convection together accounting for approximately 75% of the heat loss. The initial drop in temperature after induction is driven by a core to periphery redistribution, not environmental loss, and then the plateau is mostly at the environmental loss. And consequences of hypothermia include prolonged drug metabolism, coagulopathy, and wound infection. Key concept six, shivering increases oxygen consumption by up to 200% and can occur even in normothermic patients postoperatively. The best pharmacological treatment is meperidine, one of the few remaining clinical niches for that drug. Other options include clonidine, magnesium, and tramadol. And when cooling a patient actively, like during MH, stop at 38 degrees Celsius to avoid iatrogenic hypothermia. So you want to sort of let that last little bit drift down passively without active cooling. Anything to add for hypothermia?
I'll just say that I've even seen quotes up to 500% for how much shivering can increase oxygen consumption. And that's really key because especially if you have a, for example, an oral board stem or something where they're giving you a patient who's cold and maybe also has coronary artery disease, this is a big deal, right? So this is a major reason you don't want to extubate a patient who's cold, is because if they shiver and that oxygen demand goes up by 200 to 500%, that's a big deal for someone who may be on a little bit of an edge in terms of their oxygen supply and demand balance.
That's a really good point. Question five, a patient is shivering vigorously in the PACU after a 3-hour abdominal case. Her temperature is 35.2 degrees. Which of the following is true? A, shivering only occurs in a setting of hypothermia. B, shivering increases oxygen consumption by up to 50%. Or C, shivering can be treated with meperidine.
Great. So you can shiver without being hypothermic. Obviously, you can shiver from, you can have rigors, for example, from a fever, right? The opposite, as well as some various drug effects and things. And so that's not the answer. We just talked about the fact that shivering increases oxygen consumption, not by 50%, but by 200 to 500%. So that's an incorrect answer. So it's going to be, as you mentioned before, that it can be treated with meperidine.
Right. And you mentioned some of the other causes of shivering. But yeah, transfusion reactions, pain, residual anesthetic can all compound that.
Hey, folks, I just want to take a second to shout out our rockstar returning sponsor, TrueLearn Smart Banks. I've used TrueLearn for my residents for years, and it is hands down the best smart bank out there. The questions are excellent, and the answers have clear explanations that break down why each choice is correct or incorrect. And now you can create flashcards, which are a key tool for high-quality studying and maximizing test performance. The education research is clear that spaced repetition with these kind of tools is the best way to learn and retain information. We use their ITE, basic, and advanced smart banks for our residents, each with 1,000-plus questions, realistic visuals and graphs, and even a calculator that mimics what you have on the exam. Our residents love it and get great results. TrueLearn even has a CME smart bank where you can get AMA, PRA, Category 1 credits after you finish training, and an adult cardiac anesthesiology smart bank as well. Go to TrueLearn.com and use code ACRAG to get $25 off residency exams, USMLE, and Comlex smart bank subscriptions of 90 days or longer, and up to 20% off other healthcare exam subscriptions. We rely on TrueLearn for our test prep, and I recommend you do the same. TrueLearn.com and use code ACRAG.
Okay, and we're back.
Question six, which mechanism accounts for the greatest proportion of intraoperative heat loss in an adult? A, conduction to the OR table, B, radiation and convection combined, or C, evaporation from the surgical site?
Yeah, so you mentioned this in your overview, but it's definitely radiation and convection combined. And, you know, I think that when I think about it, I think, okay, you know, you're not really touching the OR table very much, right? We don't put people on a bare OR table. And even if you are, it's just, well, you know, kind of your backside, right? It's not your whole body, whereas your whole body can radiate and experience convection. And then evaporation from the surgical site obviously can have an effect, but that's also just the surgical site. It's not your whole body. So the thing that your whole body experiences is radiation and convection.
Yep. And I don't think I got through my board exams. I think this came up on every IT and basic exam. I'm not sure if I had it on my advanced exam, but they, for some reason, just really want you to know that.
Yeah.
Moving on to bronchospasm, key concept seven. Intraoperative bronchospasm presents with wheezing, elevated peak pressures, and shark fin capnography waveform. The differential for high peak airway pressures also includes endobronchial intubation, pneumothorax, kinked endotracheal tube, and mucus plugging. So just because you see the high peak pressure doesn't mean it's bronchospasm. The first line treatment, if it is bronchospasm, is deepening the anesthetic, and both volatiles and propofol are bronchodilators, so that's the reason you deepen the anesthetic, and giving inhaled beta-2 agonists, and then other bronchodilating agents if you need them include epinephrine, magnesium, ketamine, and corticosteroids. Steroids do work, but they take hours to work. I give it early if it's really severe bronchospasm, but don't expect that to change the course in the OR. Anything to add there, Jed?
Nope, I think you covered it.
All right, then let's test your knowledge with question seven. A patient with a history of asthma is intubated for an appendectomy. Peak airway pressures rise to 45 centimeters of water with bilateral expiratory wheezing. You deepen the volatile anesthetic and give albuterol. Which of the following would not be useful in this acute setting? A, inhaled chromalin sodium, B, intravenous magnesium sulfate, or C, subcutaneous epinephrine?
So as you talked about, both magnesium and epinephrine are good, helpful treatments, especially in severe bronchospasm. Inhaled chromalin sodium was not something you listed. And so that we know is the answer, though certainly not a drug that I don't think I've ever used.
Yeah, so it's one of the mast cell stabilizers. So it has a role in preventing bronchospasm. If you think you're at really high risk for bronchospasm, you have a patient with just bronchospasm every single time they were in the OR, not unreasonable to give it. It's just not going to do anything once those mast cells have degranulated and you're in the middle of a bronchospasm.
Fabulous.
And then we need to touch on a surprisingly often tested latex allergy. Key concept 8, latex allergy is an IgE-mediated, so type 1 hypersensitivity that characteristically presents more than 30 minutes after exposure. This is later than drug reactions, which typically occur within 5, 10 minutes or even a shorter time frame. High-risk groups are patients who have spina bifida, usually from repeated catheterizations and exposure to latex early in their lives, and healthcare workers who are also exposed to latex. Latex accounts for approximately 15% of perioperative allergic reactions under anesthesia, but note that neuromuscular blocking agents and antibiotics are the most common cause of perioperative anaphylaxis overall. More than 60% are neuromuscular blockades and antibiotics. Anything to add to key concept 8?
No, it's interesting. I think it's less common because we've moved away from latex a lot, but you're right, it still gets tested. And so I think you have to know it.
Yeah, and something that just gets still called out at every time out.
Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Hey, folks. Lately, I've been more intentional about what I wear day to day, leaning into pieces that feel easy, comfortable, and still put together. It just makes getting dressed simpler. Quince has been my go-to. The fabrics feel elevated, the fits are clean, and everything just works without needing to overthink it. Quince has all the wardrobe staples for spring. Think 100% European linen shorts and shirts from $34. Lightweight, breathable, and comfortable, but still look put together. And clean 100% Pima cotton tees with softness that has to be felt. Their pants also hit that same balance, relaxed and comfortable, but still polished enough to wear pretty much anywhere. Everything is priced 50 to 80% less than what you'd find at similar brands. Quince works directly with ethical factories and cuts out the middlemen, so you're getting premium materials without the markup. I absolutely love the zip-up fleece I got from Quince. I wear it all the time, and it might be the only thing my wife and daughters actually compliment me on. And it didn't cost anywhere near what I thought it would. Refresh your everyday with luxury you'll actually use. Head to quince.com/ACRAC for free shipping on your order and 365-day returns. That's quince.com/ACRAC for free shipping and 365-day returns. Now available in Canada too. quince.com/ACRAC.
Hey, folks. Do you ever go out to eat and feel stressed or disappointed because you know you can't enjoy the foods you love without worrying how you'll feel afterwards? Well, with Fodzyme, you can enjoy your favorite foods without the pain. That discomfort you feel might be from something in those foods called FODMAPs. I know how frustrating it can feel to feel off after eating. I get it. I was there too. Then I found Fodzyme, a simple sprinkle over my food, and I experienced much less discomfort. And I got to eat my favorite foods again. For example, I've always loved garlic, but have really struggled with how it makes me feel afterwards. But Fodzyme really helps. Fodzyme is a tasteless powder you sprinkle right onto your food. It helps break down FODMAPs before they cause discomfort. Think of it like Lactaid, but for garlic, onions, wheat, beans, cheese, and other common foods with FODMAPs. And here's what really sets Fodzyme apart. Every customer gets free access to a product consultation with an actual registered dietitian who can help you build a plan that works for your life. We're so excited to partner with Fodzyme and offer you 30% off your first order when you go to iCanEatAgain.com/ACRAC. That's iCanEatAgain.com/ACCRAC for 30% off your first order. Finally, you can enjoy your favorite foods without the pain. Just go to iCanEatAgain.com/ACRAC. All right, and we're back.
Question 8. A 28-year-old woman with spina bifida develops hypotension, tachycardia, and urticaria 40 minutes after induction of propofol, fentanyl, and rocuronium. Of the following, which is the most likely cause? A, propofol allergy, B, latex allergy, or C, rocuronium allergy?
So tricky, because you may know that rocuronium is one of the most common causes of anaphylaxis in the OR. But the key here are two things. One, the patient has spina bifida, which already should get your antenna up about possibly latex allergy. And then also this happened, they're specifically telling you 40 minutes after induction. And while not impossible for that to be from something used in induction, the fact that they're giving you it after 30 minutes makes it a little more likely that it's a type 1 hypersensitivity reaction, as you mentioned, that tend to be more than 30 minutes after exposure. And so latex is probably your most likely answer here.
Yeah, I think it's the best test answer question. And as you were describing it, I started thinking about, like, what happens 40 minutes after induction? It's usually incision. You've usually given a little bit more paralytic. So, like, could this be rocuronium? Absolutely. You may have redosed it and, you know, sensitized the first time. Don't add things to the stem that's not there. This is a latex allergy as written.
Yeah.
And I don't know why bronchospasm and laryngospasm are split up by latex allergy in the outline, but then we move next on to laryngospasm and post-obstructive pulmonary edema. So staying true to the list the way they gave it to us. Key concept 9 is going to be laryngospasm, which along with aspiration are two of the most serious extubation complications. Laryngospasm is most likely when the patient is in a light plane between anesthesia and full wakefulness. Treatment should include jaw thrust with positive pressure mask ventilation with 100% O2, Larson's maneuver, which is different than a jaw thrust, and suctioning to remove any secretions causing laryngospasm, and if you needed succinylcholine to relax those cords quickly. Key concept 10, post-obstructive negative pressure pulmonary edema occurs when forceful inspiration against an obstructed glottis generates extremely negative intrathoracic pressure, driving fluid into the alveoli. It presents within minutes to an hour after the insult with bilateral infiltrates and trophy pink secretions. Treatment is supportive with oxygen, CPAP, PEEP, or intubation if necessary, and diuresis to get that fluid off. In most cases, self-resolve within about 24 hours.
Yeah, sounds good.
Question number 9, a healthy patient who underwent a laparoscopic appendectomy is extubated and develops stridor with paradoxical chest movement. Jaw thrust and positive pressure ventilation with 100% O2 are applied, but the obstruction does not break. What is the next most appropriate step? A, reintubate immediately with a video laryngoscope. B, administer succinylcholine. Or C, administer rocuronium.
Yeah, so the reason A is not correct is because you have probably laryngospasm here, so you're not going to be able to intubate. And even if it's not 100% complete laryngospasm, you're going to have to jam a tube through mostly closed cords, and you could really cause some damage to the cord. So you need to use a paralytic first. Now, if they had given you, you know, Larson's maneuver while the SAT is still 100%, you know, could you do some other things? Could you give some propofol, for example? Yeah, but they didn't give you those options. So it's going to be either B or C. And honestly, rocuronium is fine, except presumably you just reversed your prior rocuronium. And so, you know, they don't give you that, but you have to think probably I reversed it. And so there's still some Sugammadex or neostigmine or whatever you gave floating around. It may not be the most successful to give rocuronium. And I have a better option here of succinylcholine, which will definitely work and be the fastest possible option. So I think they want you to go for succinylcholine here.
Yeah, and I think, you know, when they tell you a healthy patient, too, they're sort of letting you know if you're starting to worry about, well, what about potassium? What about, you shouldn't worry about it with a healthy patient. In question number 10, following a laparoscopic appendectomy, a patient develops laryngospasm and extubation secondary to aspiration of gastric contents. 20 minutes later, he is hypoxic with bilateral infiltrates and trophy secretions in the endotracheal tube after reintubation. What is the most likely diagnosis? A, aspiration pneumonitis. B, pulmonary embolism, or C, negative pressure pulmonary edema.
Yeah, so what there's no reason to say pulmonary embolism here, but they're giving you aspiration pneumonitis as your major distractor. So you've got this patient who has laryngospasm, and they're telling you they aspirated gastric contents. So it's going to be very tempting to say aspiration pneumonitis, except that this is very quick. This is 20 minutes later, and he's already got bilateral infiltrates, frothy secretions in the ET tube. So they're really describing pulmonary edema much more than they're describing aspiration pneumonitis. And in a patient who has laryngospasm from whatever cause, whether it's from aspiration or from anything else, if they then try to take a breath and their cords are closed, that can cause negative pressure pulmonary edema. So this is really a picture of negative pressure pulmonary edema, but that aspiration pneumonitis is a tricky distractor.
Perfect. And speaking of gastric contents, key concept 11, aspiration severity depends on the pH. Less than 2.5 is a risk factor, and a volume greater than 0.4 mL per kilogram is a risk factor of aspirated material. Three syndromes exist: mechanical obstruction from the particulate matter, acid pneumonitis or Mendelsohn syndrome, which was a distractor in the previous answer, and then bacterial pneumonia. Initial treatment is supportive. Saline lavage may be necessary during bronchoscopy for mechanical obstruction if it really got a lot of contents down, but it can worsen hypoxemia, so it's generally not recommended. If there's a little aspiration, you don't have to bronch and use saline lavage. And then prophylactic antibiotics and steroids do not improve outcomes and may increase the risk of secondary infection, so they're also not recommended.
Great.
Anything to add about key concept 11?
I think that, you know, one of the really key things is you may be asked somehow about, you know, aspiration pneumonia versus aspiration pneumonitis. And aspiration pneumonia just doesn't happen right away, right? It takes time. And so any aspiration can become aspiration pneumonia, but you don't know right away, and you don't assume that it will. Maybe there could be some exceptions with extremely immunocompromised patients or something, but with your everyday patient, you're going to assume that if there's a reaction that involves hypoxia, it's probably, and infiltrates on x-ray, it's probably aspiration pneumonitis, and if it doesn't resolve in a day or two, then it may be developing into aspiration pneumonia.
Perfect. Question 11. A patient aspirates gastric contents during extubation and develops bilateral infiltrates with worsening hypoxemia in the PACU. Which intervention is most likely to be beneficial? A, lung protective ventilation with low tidal volumes and PEEP. B, prophylactic broad-spectrum antibiotics. Or C, intravenous methylprednisolone.
Okay, so here again, we now have a description of pretty immediate infiltrates and hypoxemia after an aspiration. So this is aspiration pneumonitis until proven otherwise. As you went over, Tim, antibiotics and steroids do not help. And so what we want to do is protect those lungs from further damage. They are inflamed. They were just burned, right? They just essentially got a burn. So we want to be careful and gentle with them. And so low tidal volume ventilation is going to, and lowering driving pressure, which is optimizing PEEP as well, is what's going to protect the lungs.
Yeah, and I'll be honest, I don't think you're wrong about the diagnosis here. It could be aspiration pneumonitis. I don't know that this isn't also a description of negative pressure pulmonary edema, right? They don't give you the pink throphy secretions, but it's bilateral infiltrates with hypoxemia. If it's laryngospasm, it could be the same thing. Both of those, if you're hypoxemic, lung protective ventilation with low tidal volumes and PEEP is the correct answer.
Great.
And lastly, we'll move on to malignant hyperthermia, which is heavily tested across genetics, pathophysiology, clinical presentation, and management. Expect multiple angles on your board examinations. Key concept 12. Malignant hyperthermia is an autosomal dominant pharmacogenetic disorder triggered by volatile anesthetics and succinylcholine. In 50 to 80% susceptible patients, the culprit is a mutation in the ryanodine receptor gene, RYR1, which controls calcium release from the sarcoplasmic reticulum. More than 210 mutations exist, and a negative cardiac, negative genetic test does not eliminate susceptibility. Prior uneventful anesthetics with triggering agents are also not reassuring because 50% of patients who develop MH had two or more prior trigger exposures without incident. Key concept 13, triggering agents cause uncontrolled calcium release from the sarcoplasmic reticulum, producing a massive hypermetabolic state. So you have rising end-tidal carbon dioxide. That's the earliest and most sensitive sign, followed by tachycardia, rigidity, acidosis, rhabdomyolysis, and hyperkalemia. Fever is a late finding, despite being in the name. And mortality used to be around 70% before dantrolene, and now it's pretty low. It's less than 5%. Key concept 14 and our last one for the day. Dantrolene blocks calcium release from the sarcoplasmic reticulum, so it's our treatment of choice. The dose is 2.5 milligrams per kilogram IV, and you repeat it every 5 minutes until the patient responds. So lower end-tidal carbon dioxide, decreased rigidity, lowering of the heart rate. An additional treatment for a malignant hypothermia includes active cooling, reversal of acidosis, addressing hyperkalemia if it's present, and diuresing to greater than 1 ml per kilogram per hour to protect the kidneys from the rhabdomyolysis. And don't forget, if you're in the middle of a MH crisis or concerned about it, there's always the MHouse hotline that you can call for help with diagnosis or treatment. And recall there are a couple of mimics. Neuroleptic malignant syndrome is the key mimic. That's dopamine antagonist induced, develops over 24 to 72 hours. It's non-inherited and not triggered by succinylcholine or volatiles. And then the other one is serotonin storm, which has hyperreflexia, clonus, and shivering, compared to the lead pipe rigidity of a neuroleptic malignant syndrome. And then for neuroleptic versus MH, think about the time frame. MH is pretty immediate. Neuroleptic malignant syndrome kind of lags 24 to 72 hours. Ready for questions?
Let's do it.
All right, last set of questions, Jed. Home stretch. Question 12. A 23-year-old male undergoes an open appendectomy with sevoflurane and succinylcholine. 1 hour in, entitled carbon dioxide rises to 78 millimeters of mercury despite serial increases in minute ventilation on the ventilator. His jaw was difficult to open on induction, and his temperature is now 38.1 degrees Celsius. What is the earliest and most sensitive indicator of MH in this case? A, temperature elevation, B, muscle rigidity, or C, rising entitled carbon dioxide?
Yeah, it's a little tricky. So if, as you said, the first indicator is going to be rising entitled CO2, but it's tricky in this question because they tell you that on induction, his jaw was difficult to open. And so it seems like that came first. But remember, many, many jaws are difficult to open on induction, right? That's why we give the paralytic and wait for the paralytic to kick in. And so that it's too early for that to have been the issue. Plus, at that point, he hasn't been given the sevoflurane and maybe just got the succinylcholine. So too early for that jaw rigidity to be from the malignant hyperthermia. So it's going to be the rising entitled CO2.
Yeah, I think if it gave you master spasm as the phrase for his jaw was difficult to open, you might have a reason to choose that. If that was the answer, but I think the muscle rigidity sort of reflects the whole body state, not just the masseter spasm. And just know, like we said in the keywords, the rising entitled CO2 is the earliest, most sensitive sign of malignant hyperthermia.
Yeah.
Question 13, which of the following correctly describes dantrolene's mechanism of action in malignant hyperthermia treatment? A, it blocks acetylcholine release at the neuromuscular junction. B, it inhibits calcium release from the sarcoplasmic reticulum, or C, it competitively antagonizes volatile anesthetics at the ryanodine receptor.
And this you just have to know, as you went over, Tim, that it inhibits calcium release from the sarcoplasmic reticulum.
Yeah, and it's a straightforward question that you just need to know. I just love it for how many phrases they stuck in there that if you don't know it, sounds kind of right, yeah. And isn't the right answer. Question 14, a 19-year-old with a family history of malignant hyperthermia is scheduled for a laparoscopic cholecystectomy under TEVA. She tested negative for RYR mutation, one mutation. Which statement is most accurate? A, she can safely receive volatile anesthetics given her negative genetic test. B, she is not at risk if her parents tolerated prior general anesthetics without incident. Or C, a negative genetic test does not eliminate her risk of developing malignant hyperthermia.
So as you said, she is not able to eliminate her risk by having a negative genetic test. There are other mutations that aren't tested for that could be the cause. So C is your correct answer, that a negative genetic test does not eliminate her risk of developing MH.
Yeah, she might have at 211 for whatever number we're up to at this point. Question 15, you are treating a patient for fulminant malignant hyperthermia. You have given dantrolene and begun active cooling. The core temperature is now 38 degrees. What should you do? A, stop active cooling. B, continue cooling to 37 degrees Celsius. Or C, continue cooling until rigidity resolves.
Yeah, and as you went over, you want to stop active cooling at 38 degrees so that you don't overshoot and cause hypothermia. So you're going to stop active cooling.
Yeah, and rigidity resolving is when you would consider stopping giving repeated doses of dantrolene, not cooling. And the last question, question 16. A patient on haloperidol and sertraline develops fever, rigidity, and autonomic instability 24 hours postoperatively following an ENT procedure during which they received succinylcholine. Which of the following is the most likely diagnosis? A, serotonin storm. B, neuroleptic malignant syndrome. Or C, malignant hyperthermia.
Yeah, so this is tricky. These come up and they just are tricky. You went over this. And so you know it's not serotonin storm because that has hyperreflexia and clonus and shivering, but not fever and rigidity. And so you're deciding between NMS and MH. And I think what this really comes down to is the time period. So this is 24 hours post-op. And they also are giving you, of course, these anti-dopaminergic medications. So ultimately, it is going to come down to that time period. If they had said this happened, you know, in the OR, I think that would be much trickier. But here, because it's 24 hours after, I think it's more likely to be neuroleptic malignant syndrome.
Yeah, these things run together a little bit and can be hard to tease apart. I think if they gave you like lead pipe rigidity, you know, that would be slam dunk one for one sort of keyword. If you see that, that's neuroleptic malignant syndrome. If they talked about more of a spastic picture, maybe that would be serotonin storm. But neuroleptic malignant syndrome with this time frame and this stem is the best answer.
And I should say, Tim, I said medicines, but it's just the one the haloperidol. It's the anti-dopamine. Yep. Then they give you the sertraline, which is the SSRI. So it's quite tricky because they're giving you the serotonin and the dopamine. So you really have to think about each of those and what their symptoms are.
Perfect. That's all I've got.
Fabulous. All right. A lot of great stuff here. Let's turn to the part of our show where we make random recommendations. What do you have to recommend that the audience check out for fun?
I'm going to a classic and one of my favorites, Go Outside. I can't recommend it enough. There's fresh air. There are these green things, plants. They make oxygen. It's so good to breathe. There's yellow orb in the sky. It heats you up and warms you. Sometimes water comes from the sky. They call it rain. It's absolutely magical. Just go outside.
Love it. Yeah, it is amazing. Especially, you know, we get so busy and it's easy just to forget about that. But the other day I was walking to some event at my daughter's school. And it was just a gorgeous day, and I was out walking, and I just realized, man, I haven't like just gone for a walk in a while, and it is really, it's beautiful, it's nice, it's a way to just relax a little bit, breathe, take a break from the work you're doing. So couldn't agree more. I'm going to recommend for when you're not outside a show my wife and I found recently called Slow Horses. It's on Apple TV Plus. And it's really, it's great. We finished the first season. We're on to the second. It's really entertaining. Well done. It's about a group of kind of misfit British spies who end up taking on some important cases and really well done and suspenseful. Very well acted as well. So I highly recommend it. Slow Horses on Apple TV Plus.
If it's not a spoiler, what in the world is the name from?
Yeah,
I guess that's what it's about.
I'm sure people in England know this, but my understanding from the show is that a slow horse is like a underperforming person, at least an underperforming spy. So they are called slow horses because they're, you know, kind of slow, like not smart. Not that they aren't, but that that's how they're labeled. And then the name of the location where they work is called Slaw House, and it sounds like Slow House, and so I think that's part
of
it.
Got it.
All right. Thanks so much, Tim. We'll see you next time.
Of course. Thank you.
All right. Hopefully you got as much out of that as I did. That was really fantastic. Let us know what you thought. Go to the website, acrac.com, where you can leave a comment. Others can learn from what you have to say. If you are a fan of the show, you can follow us. We're on Twitter. We are on Facebook. We are on Reddit, and we are on Instagram. I'm at Jay Wolpaw on Twitter, and we're at ACRAC Podcast, and you can find us on all those other platforms as well. If you are a fan of the show, please consider going to Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts and leaving a comment and a rating. It really helps others find the show. If you'd like to support the making of the show, please consider going to patreon.com/ACRAC. That's patreon.com/ACRAC, where you can become a patron of the show. Even if it's just a dollar or two that you pledge, it makes a big difference, and we really appreciate it. You can also make donations anytime by going to paypal.me/ACRAC or looking up Jay Wolpaw on Venmo. Thank you so much to those who have already made donations and become patrons. We really appreciate it. Thanks, as always, to our fantastic ACRAC crew. Sonia Amanat is our tech lead. Taylor Duggan, William Mao, and Rachel Furman are our production assistants and social media managers. Thanks so much for all you do. Our original ACRAC music is by Dr. Dennis Kuo. You can check out his website at studymusicproject.com. All right. That is it for today. For the ACRAC podcast, I'm Jed Wolpaw. Thanks for listening. Remember, what you're doing out there every day is really important and valued.